TalkZone.com.
Now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Hello, and welcome to Wild About Pets. This is the place we talk in depth to leading authors and experts about everything concerning wild animals or household pets. To make your listening experience more enjoyable and meaningful, I have a companion website, wildaboutpets.net, that allows you to see photographs of the animals we'll be talking about on the show today. To see these pictures while you are listening, click the purple Look While You Listen button you see on the Talk Zone Wild About Pets homepage. I first read about the idea of a frozen zoo, which are tanks of liquid nitrogen that preserved sperm, eggs, and embryos from hundreds of endangered species in the exciting scientific thriller The Altar of Eden by best-selling author James Rollins. In this novel, this frozen zoo was housed in a facility that the author's main character, a veterinarian named Dr. Lorna Polk, worked. The facility's name was the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species. At this facility described in the book, they had the daunting responsibility of trying to pull endangered species back from the brink of extinction through artificial insemination, embryo transfer, and cloning. Wow, cloning used to save endangered animals. This was a new twist for me to think about, given what I've read through the years about cloning. You know, that word holds so much debate and mystery between the truth and the facts, the stuff of futuristic science, wild imaginations and fears, heated debate and controversy. What if this science was actually being used for saving animals from extinction, though, as described in the novel Altar of Eden? Well, guess what? It is. The frozen zoo is real. The Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species is real. And my guest today, Dr. Betsy Dresser, leader of the research team at this actual facility, is here today to tell us about how she and other scientists, veterinarians, and animal managers are pioneering sophisticated techniques in the pursuit of saving endangered animals. Welcome, Dr. Dresser. I am thrilled to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Susan. I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Betsy Dresser is a reproductive physiologist who joined Audubon Nature Institute in 1995 to lead the new research and survival center. I have some photos of the animals we'll be talking about today during this program, so if you'd like to see them while you are listening, click the purple Look While You Listen button that you see on my Talk Zone show homepage. This will take you right to the photos that are on my own website, wildaboutpets.net. This way, you can look while you listen. The phone lines are also open today. It's February 26th, 2010. We are streaming live right now. So if you'd like to join our conversation and ask Dr. Dresser a question, call 888-463-6748. Or you can email me at susan@wildaboutpets.net. We also have a free giveaway today in honor of the Chicagoland Family Pet Expo coming to Arlington Park Racecourse in Arlington Heights, Illinois on March 19th, 20th, and 21st. Call in or email me with your question and you may win up to 4 free tickets to this fun event for the whole family. Again, it's February 26th and the number to call is 888-GO-FOR-IT. Dr. Dresser, your facility has been recently featured in the best-selling novel by James Rollins, Altar of Eden, who I also interviewed on this show, and in a segment on television, CBS's 60 Minutes. How has this popular media attention been for you all, and has it had any effect?
Well, it's been great from the aspect that I think it created an awareness more so of us, and actually, since we depend a lot on funding from private individuals, we've had a great response that way. And also people just, wanting to know more about this kind of science to help save endangered species, and that's what we're all about.
Tell me then, what is the mission of the facility?
Well, Susan, we're here to develop science and technologies that we can use to apply to reproducing endangered species, because, you know, animals are endangered because they're low in number. And so if we can develop all of these different scientific approaches through technology to try to increase offspring numbers of a lot of these endangered species, then essentially we do keep them from going extinct. So our mission is just to develop really good, strong science that we can apply to reproducing endangered species.
Now, I also noticed in your published mission statement, you talk about accelerating reproduction and preserving genetic heritage. What are some of the ways exactly in which you become involved? Like, you know, are babies being born, or are you doing reintroductions? Or can you kind of give us a nutshell, before we get into the actual science, of the ways in which you are helping preserve?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, we do have a frozen zoo. And so in the frozen zoo, what we're doing is really essentially banking DNA from a lot of individual animals so that we preserve their genetics that way. We're also producing babies. Even as we thaw cells, we want to make sure they're viable, so we produce babies from these cells. And also we are reintroducing animals. We have a large crane program here where we each year release chicks that we've produced from frozen sperm back into the wild. We've put wolves back into the wild, or actually we've given them to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who owns them. But all of those ways, actually, and the science underlies all of it.
In fact, we have a picture that you had lent me of the frozen zoo, and this is picture number 10. So if anybody wants to see this, it's actually this gray cement-looking canister with a blue lid with the actual words frozen zoo on it. And again, if you want to see the photos, just click the purple Look While You Listen button on the Talk Zone page, and it's on my website. And again, we're looking at picture number 10. You know, Dr. Dresser, when I read about this in the novel, as I mentioned in my introduction, I really thought this was, you know, science fiction. And so I was fascinated when I found out this was real. So how many different species are actually represented in your frozen zoo?
We've got about about 700 species, and we've got about 5,000 individuals right now in the frozen zoo. So it's really growing.
And these are sperm and eggs and embryos, just like mentioned in the book?
Yeah, exactly. And also, now with the onset of cloning that you mentioned, all we need to do is take a skin sample and grow the cells out so that we have multiple copies of them, and then we freeze these. So really, cloning has allowed us to preserve more genetic material, because every animal we get our hands on now, we take a small little skin sample and preserve the DNA.
Oh, well, there's so much to talk about, and we're going to look at some of the animals that you mentioned, because I've got the crane photographs and I got the cat photographs. But I guess since you mentioned the word cloning, let's get right to that, because as I said, you know, that word holds so much weight, and, you know, we'll talk about trying to separate some of the fears and myths from the facts. But basically, in a nutshell, Dr. Dresser, what is cloning?
Cloning, at least for us, is actually making or being able to make multiple copies of, let's say, a highly valuable bloodline in a particular species. And we do it by taking cells from an individual who represents this particular bloodline, or one that's not reproducing naturally, or one that's old and, you know, isn't represented in the bloodline. Essentially, what you do is you take the DNA, and we use it to form embryos by inserting it into eggs of individuals from a particular species, and then transferring the embryos, and then we produce babies that way. So what we have now then are multiple copies of an individual, where the individual may have not been able to contribute at all to the bloodlines.
And one example is the cat Ditto.
Exactly.
Okay, that's we have a picture of Ditto in photograph number 1, and Ditto was a wildcat.
Yes, an African wildcat.
Okay, so tell us the story of Ditto.
Did you notice how it's spelled, too?
Yes, I love it. It's D-I-T-T-E-A-U-X.
Right.
With a French twist, of course, you being in Louisiana.
Yeah, in New Orleans there. Ditto was a clone of one of our other African wildcats who was very valuable to us. And so he was our first African wildcat, or the first African wildcat that was cloned. And again, it was, you know, just to show that that we could use this science to do that. So he was the first.
And then you were able to produce, or Ditto was bred with another wildcat or a domestic cat?
No, with another wildcat, another cloned wildcat, okay. Actually, that was unrelated to Ditto. So that what we could show was that clones, because there was a lot of criticism of cloning, that, you know, the offspring wouldn't be normal and, you know, they wouldn't reproduce. And so what we wanted to do was just let him naturally breed so that we could show that kittens could be produced, African wildcat kittens. And indeed, that's what happened.
And so example photograph number 2, those are some of Ditto's litter of kittens also?
Right, uh-huh.
Okay,
yep.
They are so adorable.
Aren't they cute?
And then we have pictures, of course, your lab and some of the very sophisticated equipment in pictures 3, 4, and 5. And then some more pictures of some of the kittens. But I also put up one of your diagrams, cloning mm-hmm. the next generation. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to read the print, but maybe you can summarize what you already did, but talk us through that diagram a little bit.
Well, as you can see, what we've done is we've taken a sample from the African wildcat. This could have been Ditto, could have been another one. Meanwhile, from a domestic cat, we've taken some eggs because we need to put the DNA from the wildcat into an egg of some kind, and obviously it needs to be a close relative. So the domestic cat produces lots of eggs, even that we can get from spay-neuter clinics, material that's just going to be thrown away. We take the eggs from the ovaries, and we insert the DNA from the endangered African wildcat into the egg of the domestic cat. So I want to be clear, we're not hybridizing these animals. All we're doing is using the egg as a method to get it to go on and produce an embryo. And so once the DNA is in there, we have to use what we call electric fusion. It's actually what was discovered when Dolly the sheep was produced, mm-hmm. that you could use this electrical pulse, and what it does is causes the egg to activate with the new DNA, and it will then go on and divide and become an embryo. And then the embryo is put back into a domestic cat that just acts as a surrogate. So what she's got are embryos of African wildcats, but she's just the carrier. She's like an oven that's nurturing these embryos. And so when the kittens are born, they're actually full African wildcat.
And then photograph number 7 shows another one with a ball. So I suppose, of course, the kittens, just like any kitten, would be very playful.
Right, yep.
And then also the triplets. Now, these were all some of the litters of Ditto?
The actual triplets were unrelated to Ditto. They were clones from another a female that we wanted to clone, who was very valuable.
Okay. And then I see you even have an African wildcat clone family tree.
Yeah.
And again, it's a little hard to read this, but it gives people the idea of all the different litters you've had and how there are offshoots. Now, as you were talking about the procedures, it sounds like just extracting eggs or inserting DNA does not harm these animals.
No, not at all.
They're all living animals. And the idea of using these African wildcats, Dr. Dresser, is this a particular cat that is highly endangered in Africa right now?
It is endangered. It's not the most endangered cat, mm-hmm. but again, you know, this technology had not been used at all in exotic cats. And so what we wanted to do was take one that was a species that was somewhat valuable and yet that we could follow over the years, you know, to see how all of this worked. And that's why you see the family tree there. You know, it's important to be able to produce them a number of times so that we know that the science is working. And so what we're doing now, though, is applying what we learned in the African wildcat to some very highly endangered African black-footed cats, as well as as sand cats and numbers of other cats. And the African wildcat was really, you know, our beginning here.
How is it determined in the first place which animals you wind up working with?
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of it depends on availability of the animals because, you know, when you're dealing with endangered species, a lot of times you don't have the numbers of animals to work with. And the other thing is dependent on funding. I mean, you know, sometimes donors or different grant monies that are available will apply to certain species, but not others. And so it really depends on funding and availability of animals.
And I understand that you do not work in a vacuum by yourself. You work with many different organizations. There's a collaboration with a number of different places and centers. Do you get funding from all these, or is it mostly private donors who are funding?
Yeah, it's a variation. You're right. We do. We work with a lot of different organizations because, you know, these animals are so valuable and that we, you know, we want to work together. And so sometimes government funds are available. We do get a lot of private donations, people that just either like cats generally or they want certain, you know, species of cats. Cats are really, really of interest to the public, I have to tell you. And so if we can use the domestic cat as a surrogate for embryos from a lot of these small endangered cats, I mean, to us, that's really important. So,
and to make sure I'm clear on this, so the domestics are just a surrogate. You're not, as you said, you're not blending the genetics of a domestic and a wild. So getting, you know, a mix, the wildcats remain, the clones remain completely genetically pure as wild animals.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you were to be around when they grow up, they can become nasty little cats.
Sure. Well, is there, I know we're going to talk about the very successful program that you had with the Mississippi Sandhill Cranes and reintroduction. Is there any hope for some of the cats to be reintroduced into the wild?
Yeah, there's always hope. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem worldwide mm-hmm. today because, you know, we as a species are destroying so much of their habitat that sometimes there's nowhere for these animals to go back into.
Mm-hmm.
So we can only hope that organizations, you know, like World Wildlife Fund or Nature Conservancy, all those really great organizations that save habitat, we can only hope, you know, they're moving as quickly as we are to try to save some of these species.
Right. I was thinking in terms of your frozen zoo with, you know, all those
yeah.
represented animals that maybe the idea, and this is very science fiction and futuristic, that you'd be holding the legacy of the genetic, you know, material, those animals for the day that somewhere, somehow, they would have free homes to roam in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't know. I'm writing a book right now called Tigers to the Moon. You know, who knows, someday we may be on other planets, and at least we'll have the material.
Do you, obviously you're working in the most exciting and challenging and stimulating environment. Do you and your staff also feel the weight of the work that you're doing and almost a sense of racing against time?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we feel like we're in the emergency room of the wildlife business, really, because we have to do a lot of this and do it quick. And we you know, that's why we all work together with other zoos and aquariums. We try to encourage, you know, universities to be partners. I mean, it's going to take a lot because there's no one answer to saving wildlife. And the more that we all work together, the better.
And for all the different specimens in the frozen zoo, how is that determined of who gets to, you know, be held there?
Well, you know, there's a number of frozen zoos around the country. There's about five or six other zoos that are doing similar work. And so, you know, what we try to do is not overlap. The animals that we have here in New Orleans at our zoo and aquarium and our research center, we're able to take samples from and work with those. And then, you know, the San Diego Zoo and the National Zoo in Washington and the Cincinnati Zoo, those facilities also have frozen zoos. And so, you know, we're just trying to save as many as we can without overlapping.
Oh, that makes total sense. It is time for us to take a short break. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more right after this.